Albert Stage and Studio. We're listening to music by David Arnett Cherry. Hear his music at davidarnettcherry.com. Today we feature Paul Soucy, and we're going to learn more about his career and his projects. And so joining me right now via Zoom to talk about everything that is Paul Soucy is Paul Soucy, an educator, a social services professional, an arts administrator, an activist, and a theater artist who was born and raised in Portland, Oregon. You know, Paul, I did not know that.
That's right. I'm one of the few and the proud.
Well, you're a man of many hats. Paul Soucy, welcome to Stage and Studio. You know, my husband is also one of the few native Portlanders that I know. What was it like for you to grow up in Portland?
Yeah, it was an experience. Being a native Portlander, being a person of color, you know, son of immigrants, and even from a very young age, everybody in Portland was around me was like, this is a very white city. There are no other people of color here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas the fact is that people of color have been here all along. We've just trained ourselves not to see each other. And it was, there was something really beautiful about that, that, you know, sort of traveling in this very strange space where I was invisible, but also trying to be visible, trying to fit in, trying to assimilate. I'm sure you know a lot about that as well. You know, there are things about my childhood here in Portland that I really treasure. And then, of course, there are things that were really traumatizing that I would never want to repeat. And everything in between.
Traumatizing, yeah. I kind of wrote that into my book. Early experiences, you know, because I've been here since I was 10. And, of course, I go back another generation or so, you know, from you. But, you know, it's... To put it mildly, can be traumatizing to live here, definitely. And you're the son of immigrant parents. My mom was an immigrant as well. I'm just wondering, immigrant from Filipino lineage?
Yep, yeah. Both of my parents are from the Philippines. We think that Soucy is a Japanese name, that somewhere in the grandparent line there's a Japanese ancestor. And then just to be, you know, fully transparent, my grandmother was half Chinese. So... And my grandfather's name was Jimenez, which is a very Spanish colonial name. So I call myself a post-colonial Asian mutt.
There's a very close Latinx relationship with the Philippines. Very close.
That's right.
Bloodlines.
That's right. Right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. A Spanish colony for 500 years. And then an American colony, an American territory for about 50 years. So many layers of... You know, colonialism, imperialism, you know, assimilation, Catholicism. I see it especially in the cuisine and in Tagalog. Tagalog has a lot of borrowed words from all these different languages. Thank you in Tagalog is salamat po, and my grandparents are rolling in their graves because my pronunciation is terrible. But salamat is a borrowed word from Arabic, and hello is como esta, which is como estas in Spanish. So it's like archaeology, but it's alive, right? Where you see in the language and you see in the cuisine how these different cultures have met and have traumatized each other, but also drawn a lot of rich and amazing things from one another.
I know that you have thought about doing a personal piece or perhaps a Filipino-based play, one-person show, and I hope you do it.
Yeah,
I don't think people understand, you know, the Philippines as much as they could, and being Filipino-American, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I have been dreaming about a karaoke performance called Nestor Pinakpit Sings the Songs You Used to Love. And it's the character that I'm dreaming of is a person like me who is stranded on one of the disappearing islands in the South China Sea that have been claimed by China and Vietnam and the Philippines and America. Like, there's all this history there, and they're islands of guano, essentially, or coral, and there may be oil underneath them. So there are all these intersections of climate change and geopolitical tension and the experiences that we all have in our strange multicultural identities in this strange, strange moment in time.
I'm sure you get this question a lot, you know, because growing up in Oregon, it was always like, what are you? What, you know,
yes.
What, how did your parent, for me, it was like, how did your parents meet? Even I got questions like, why would your dad marry your mom? Or your mom was so lucky she married because she was a military bride. So it's not easy when we talk about the trauma. It's like, it's very invasive. So when we talk about our ethnicity, like in this interview setting, it's not the same as somebody coming up to you and just a stranger, you know, just out of the blue talking to you about your ethnicity, your race, you know, who you are. So I just want to make that clarification, you know, because often I feel like people want me to talk about it on a personal level when I don't even know them.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, it is so invasive. And, you know, consent in all things is always so important, but especially when it comes to one's personal identities. Yeah, it takes an effort and it takes trust. And, you know, obviously we've known each other for years and we've, you know, interacted in the community many times. And so there's a level of trust and community there. And you can't just assume that, you know, just by looking at somebody that you have permission to inquire into their personal histories.
And even when you produce a work of art, it's also not like you want to do it a talk back about it, you know?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, especially after
when it's personal.
Performing. Yeah, especially after performing. I'm always very reluctant to do that. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I respect you as an actor. You're a phenomenal actor.
Thank
but
you.
You're also a person who has worked with social services, particularly vulnerable populations, people who are unhoused, also people in the prison system, prison communities.
Yes.
What has motivated your social justice work?
Ooh, thank you for asking that. That's a great question. So when I was growing up, in 13, 14 years old, my parents split up and my mom was very sick. And so I was one of those at-risk kids. And I was briefly homeless even in high school for just a few months. And my experience of being that marginalized and that alone really made me hungry for culture. And thank goodness that I was involved in theater. Because theater, classical theater, Shakespeare, the Greeks, really gave me a vocabulary for how to create my own emotional maturity, how to be okay with things that I was powerless around. And so as I've grown, hopefully, since then, the Greek conception of theater is still really, really important to me. And Greek culture, Greek theater, you're not just a theater artist. Theater is one aspect of a complete human being. And so when I think of my work, none of the aspects of my work, whether it's in performance or in social work, is complete without all of these other pieces, all of these other facets. I need to be striving to be a person of conscience and humility, and I need to be striving to do better and learn more and grow more as a human being. So the social justice work, the social work that I do, I was a manager for Transition Projects for 5 years, where I specialized in opening emergency temporary homeless shelters. And I created 6 different facilities during that time. I was an EMT at Huber Detox. I worked with juvenile sex offenders at Janus Youth Programs. You know, all of that felt of a piece with my theater career that was running parallel to that, which is, you know, performing. It's absurd to say, but performing in Shakespeare plays, performing at Shakespeare Santa Cruz, performing at Vermont Stage Company, doing experimental work with Boom Arts and with Hand to Mouth Theater over the years. And so Northwest Classical Theater Collaborative is just the latest in a long line of theater companies that I've worked with. And Northwest Classical prioritizes reaching culturally underserved communities, communities that aren't going to be able to afford the $60 or the $80 ticket, communities that have never been exposed to theater ever in their lives, and communities that are literally segregated, immured away from us. So prison communities, adults in custody, rural communities, undereducated communities. That's where my heart really is, and it's kind of a marrying of those two sort of tracks of theater and social work.
I've also been wondering, have you worked with the unhoused community recently regarding COVID-19 pandemic and health concerns?
Certainly, yeah. So I am still very much in touch at Transition Projects. I continue to be a consultant for them and a trainer for them. I left my position as a manager just before coronavirus began. I was offered a position at the outdoor school, which is under its own transformation as a result of coronavirus. Yeah, I am very concerned and very connected with my colleagues and friends in the unhoused community. The shelter system is only just now starting to reopen, and it's staggering along, and they're creating protocols as they go. It's like building a plane while you're flying it. And there aren't good resources. There aren't good answers for the folks. I mean, we can see it every day, right? The encampments are growing. There's nowhere for folks to go. There aren't enough safety protocols or resources in place to keep the systems healthy. So the fear is that if you intake more folks into emergency shelters, unknown infections may suddenly pop up and it becomes a hotspot, and there aren't resources in place to counter that. And also, we're all very stretched thin by the current civil unrest and the federal occupation of our city. So, you know, there's like how many fires can you fight at the same time?
It seems like they're all burning at the same time right now.
They really are, yeah.
In case you just joined us, I'm Dimae Roberts, stage and studio, talking with actor and social service artist Paul Suzy. And if you missed any of the show, you can hear it again at stageandstudio.org or kbu.fm/stageandstudio. You mentioned outdoor school, that you're a site supervisor. My camp name was Moonshine when I was in outdoor school, when I was outdoor school counselor when I was in high school. And yours is?
I'm Badger. Oh, that's so wonderful that you're, that's a really great outdoor school name.
Well, I wasn't thinking of the actual liquor. I was just thinking moon and shine,
yeah.
You know, but
yeah. I love it.
And so how did you choose Badger? I just love that.
Yeah. Wind in the Willows was one of my favorite books. And I got to play Badger, Mr. Badger, in a production of Wind in the Willows many years ago. And I just, I've always admired and wanted to be that really grounded and resourceful character that Mr. Badger is. So
I love that. That's a fantastic story. What was the first time you realized you wanted to do theater, though? You mentioned the classics. That it really,
yes.
And for me, it was also Shakespeare and the Greeks, too, because I don't know, for some reason it they were always being dealing with epic situations and larger than life, and it wasn't like I just felt like I could inhabit those kind of characters more because my life was not normal at all,
Yes. This is a great story. I'll be candid. Freshman year of high school, I was following my best friend at the time, who, of course, I had a huge crush on. And she went into an audition for the Pirates of Penzance. And this was at Jesuit High School my freshman year. I went to Jesuit for just that 1 year. And I was having a miserable time of it. But, of course, I was very much in love with this person. And just, well, I mean, I'm 14. What do I know, right? It's hormones, right? I follow her into this audition, and I'm cast as a pirate at the Pirates of Penzance. And here I am 20 years later. And then following that, though, Shakespeare, I really first connected with Richard III. I really first connected with that sense of isolation and that no one understands you and everybody despises you, and why don't you just own it and seek to make that your ambition. And of course, 14, 15, 16, as you're fascinated with those kinds of villains at that age, the poetry of it, the discipline of how do you expand your consciousness and your thought to really investigate these emotions, these perceptions, these feelings, and to do that work well, even to sit and appreciate that work, you are training your intellect. And you're training your heart to see and feel things in others that help you understand what you are seeing and feeling in yourself. So that's what really got me going, was some of those history plays and then the tragedies. And And then, of course, every Shakespearean actor of my generation has been in, you know, dozens and dozens of productions of Romeo and Juliet. And it gets me every time when I hear Juliet's poetry. It's so beautiful and so sensitive and so thoughtful and passionate. And it gives voice to all those turmoil, you know, hormones and regrets and the impulsiveness of that adolescence. So yeah, that's what I fell in love with.
Well, it sounds like you're bringing this love, or you have been bringing this love, to the prison communities too. And I want to talk about sort of, is, you know, how that transition happened, because you've done traditional theater and classical theater, but you also felt you wanted to do more.
Yeah, absolutely. So Patrick Walsh, who is a director here in Portland and a good friend of mine, a couple of years ago, he approached me. He had been volunteering for several years out at Two Rivers Correctional Institution, where he was running a theater program for inmates there, for adults in custody there. He directed plays and they performed them. And this was a program started by Johnny Stallings, another local legend. And I saw their production of Winter's Tale. That must have been 5 or 6 years ago now. And it just blew me away. These guys brought so much sensitivity and so much passion. It was the best production of Winter's Tale I've seen ever. And they had, you know, hand-me-down costumes from the opera. They had lifers. These are guys who are doing 20 years to life, who invested their whole soul and their whole heart into these roles, and they researched the roles, and they'd never done theater before, but they were in it to win it, right? And Patrick wanted to create a program that would give back to them, actually, that they, because visitors would come in to see them perform, and what if they got to see visitors perform? Because obviously they're not going to be able to come out to see a production in a theater. So really, it began as an act of gratitude to these inmates. And the piece he picked for it was an Iliad. And the reason why is because this particular adaptation, it's by Lisa Peterson and Dennis O'Hare. It was created about 10 years ago as well. This particular translation is a pretty modern adaptation of the Iliad, and it's really candid about how the Iliad is about cycles of rage, cycles of violence, how these issues that we in our moment in time have been struggling with right now, we've actually been struggling with this for thousands of years, literally thousands of years. Sexual violence, homophobia, like what is the right thing to do? What is justice when you have this burden of memory and this burden of experience? PTSD, coming home from wars, you know, you can pick, like there's a grab bag of recognizable themes and issues. And he picked this play because, quite frankly, this is the kind of thing that is going to pass muster for a Department of Corrections employee. They're not going to think twice about rubber stamping, and I hope I don't jinx it by saying this on a recording, but they're not going to look too closely at, for lack of a better term, dead white guy culture. You know, it's Greek, so...
But I also think it's the classics, and so, of course, that's educational. You know, so
exactly.
It seems like the perfect fit, though, too.
Yeah.
So you had a tour, and now you're thinking of, instead, because of the pandemic, you know, it had to be canceled. But so you're thinking of filming this now, or?
Yeah. So the follow up was going to be a production of Sophocles' Antigone, an expanded cast, and we were going to go to 20 more prisons this spring, and then of course coronavirus happened. And so we have kept in touch with our contacts amongst the inmates and amongst the recreation specialists, and we are going to do a digital recording of a performance. And actually, we've just gotten permission to film in the never-used Wapato jail, which is like 9 layers of irony there, because that facility, they've been community activists have been trying to turn it into a homeless shelter for years. And, you know, there people have very strong arguments on either sides of that. And it's been a fixture in our community for a long time. And I'm just really excited that we're able to use so many of these pieces in our community for the better, right? And so instead of going to these 20 prisons, we're going to record this and streamcast it.
That's exciting. I also, you know, we're kind of running out of time because you're so fascinating to talk to. But I also want to find out more. Initially, you had sent out a call for prison pen pals.
Yes.
And so I want to talk about the Prison Pen Pal Project, or is it Prison Pal Project?
Yeah, it doesn't really have a name. I'm just trying to, I was trying to stay connected to a lot of these guys, my friends that I've made in previous tours to these prisons, and you know, with coronavirus, they shut down all access. So not only are no volunteer programs going in, you know, things like AA meetings and yoga and, you know, self-help groups, like support groups, aren't going in, but also adults in custody, they're not getting to meet with their lawyers. They're not getting to meet with their family. Like it's like all access has been completely shut off. And we were just so concerned by that I started writing to my friends and in those prisons, and we have just organically created this network of inmates who are seeking pen pals. And so, you know, if folks are interested, like I'm building this bigger and bigger network now, and you know, inmates are introducing me to other inmates via letter, and it's completely separate from the Department of Corrections, and it's a way of building and reaffirming the fact that we're all in the same community, no matter the prison walls, no matter what anybody has done or, you know, what their ethnicity is. It's so, so important that we don't forget about one another.
Can you share anything of the experiences you've had and perhaps any of, you know, you have an excerpt of a letter perhaps that you could share with us?
Certainly, yeah. As I was preparing for this meeting, I was looking back at some of my notes from way back when, from the first tour of an Iliad, and I have a letter that I wrote to a friend of mine that I just kept a copy of, because it's kind of like a diary entry of the tour. And prior to going to Oregon State Penitentiary for the first time with an Iliad, you know, I hadn't personally been inside of a prison before. And so it was a really powerful experience. And this was what I wrote. So there are a whole series of assumptions and expectations about prisons that I've accumulated, like the change in my pockets or the medal on my belt, that I have to undo and examine with some dismay as these items trundle through X-ray machines and pass through the hands of skeptical guards amid the slow dawning realizations of my own carelessness. We arrive in costume. I'm wearing a battered, stained wool overcoat, baggy carnival barker trousers, my own beaten and worn red leather boots, a ragged hoodie, a stained A-frame undershirt. In the pocket of my overcoat, I have a crumpled-up Civil War-style hat that I keep out of sight in case a corrections officer chooses to determine that it is a forbidden article of clothing because the color is blue. My mind is a rat's nest of lines from the script and the minor gray area infractions that I'm walking into this space with, and all the things that I've ever done that I've ever felt any shame about. There's technically forbidden metal on the antique QTs around my ankles, which take forever to fasten together, and there's metal in the Chinese three-coin good luck charm necklace around my neck, which feels like bad luck not to bring it in. When I take off my belt, I have to hold up my comically oversized trousers with one hand, like a Charlie Chaplin routine, as I hobble through the metal detector. This is usually when they decide that it's too much trouble to narrow down exactly where the metal is that's still pinging in their wands, so they move on to the next thing. I'm awash in the same lapping waves of anxiety that I feel at airports or when I'm stopped by a cop in traffic. But here, their weary, cynical distrust carries a special scrutiny that's partly curiosity at non-inmate-related strangers coming voluntarily to these prisons, and it's partly bemusement when they know who we are ahead of time. You can read their thoughts on their creasing, squinting faces. Now what the hell is this? This ought to be interesting. My footsteps echo down corridors in Lakeview, in Salem, in North Portland, in Hermiston. I fidget and worry beneath strangely beautiful, garish murals in prisons that are 5 years old, 10 years old, 150 years old. At every gate, I watch my driver's license disappear in metal drawers, and I worry every time that some horrible mistake will consume that little plastic card, and I'm ashamed of how afraid I am that this mistake will happen. Ritually or otherwise, I'm scrutinized, checked against my ID, cross-referenced against forms submitted weeks ago, and, improbably, I'm waved into the facility with my clomping boots and my rumpled coat. I wore much the same costume with a bit more naivete than I care to admit nearly every day of high school, and when I see myself in mirrors or windows, I'm abashed at how little about my rumpled self-same self has changed. I worry that I've been standing still, trapped in this place for 20 years, just like our audiences. I remember how casually my friends and I felt imprisoned by adolescence. With the real thing around me, the shame of careless language echoes in my heart, in cadence with the footsteps of our audiences gathering in the chow halls. Always we perform in the place where meals are served. Later, the audiences say things like, "With you, we were free for 2 hours. Don't forget us. We won't forget you."
There's something really special about getting a handwritten letter, because it's so rare these days, and you know, getting it in the mail. I also think this project could be something for school-aged children, because there are a lot of kids especially who may not have digital access. Writing letters and getting them is a great way to learn.
Yeah. There are, of course, safety considerations and special considerations around school-age folks, but I strongly agree. Yeah, it's a gentle form of communication. Every letter that is sent into a prison is going to be read by a third party, and so that's always important to put out there. But some of the letters that I've been getting, even just yesterday, I got a batch of five more adults in custody who are seeking pen pals, and it's just such a simple, basic desire to say, you know, I've been here for a long time. I haven't connected with somebody in a long, long time who's not a part of this institution. And all I want is just, you know, someone to see me for who I am.
It sounds like gratifies you a great deal personally. And you can find out more about the Prison Pen Pal Project at paulsusi, that's susi.wordpress.com. And I'll have that link, as well as the Northwest Classical Theater Collective's website, nwtc.org, where you can learn about the Antigone Project and hopefully the continuation of the Iliad Project sometime too. Paul Susi, it's just so, it warms my heart to take this time to talk with you, and thank you for doing that today via Zoom. And kudos to you on your fine work. You're very much tied to communities, and I think that's so important. So thank you, and stay healthy, stay well.
Thank you.
That's it for Stage and Studio. Hear the show again at stageandstudio.org or kbu.fm/stageandstudio. You can also get the podcast on iTunes, like us on facebook.com/stage_and_studio. Till next time, I'm Dimae Roberts. We're going out with music by David Arnett Cherry at davidarnettcherry.com.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Andy Wawo looks a scream. Hand him on my wo-o-o-o. Andy Wawo, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is sculptor Jacob Hashimoto. His new works, The City and the Sky, are now on view permanently at the Portland International Airport in the new Concourse E. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Jacob.
Oh, well, it's great to be here. I'm happy to talk about the new artworks.
You are a very well-known artist for public installation work. Usually your work consists of lots of things hanging from the ceiling, and that's exactly what we have at the new concourse, Terminal E. It's a very bright, airy space, and they've given you two beautiful locations. They're in the sort of pointy part of the roof, so you've got a lot of height, and they're next to huge windows, beautiful windows. So you've been dealing